Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Take your medicine, if you can afford it.
Certainly, prescription drugs are very, very expensive, and there is a black market, so to speak. People can buy drugs online, unfortunately. These aren't the types of drugs that are going to surface at the local CVS.
A theft of $75 million worth of prescription drugs in Connecticut suggests a black market for antidepressants.
She gave me pills on my toes, and they didn't ache. She gave me pills on my love, but it was a little too late. She gave me pills on my heart to put me at ease. The rock and roll nurse shook me dead to my knees.
Has Big Pharma's business model created a black market for prescription drugs, or is there just an army of depressed criminals out there? A rocking and rolling prescription drug industry. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, March 18th. Are we poised to really enter a crisis in prescription drug demand in the United States, a black market for prescription drugs? A discussion with Gil Kerlikowske, the White House drug czar, in just a moment.
You know, in case you're thinking about that as an idea for a film script, the whole depressed criminal thing, De Niro did it and analyzed this. It's done. Let's take a check of the morning news. Wall Street futures are up. After new economic numbers last hour, they show the number of newly laid off workers requesting jobless benefits fell for the third straight week. Meanwhile, consumer prices were flat last month. And it feels like we've been here before, right? Just days away from a crucial vote on health care. President Obama tells Fox News this weekend's vote will be close.
Somebody who votes for this bill, they're going to be judged at the polls. And the same is going to be true if they vote against it.
House Democrats are reportedly 10 votes shy, but picked up two more yesterday. Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich was the first to change his vote from no to yes.
We just mentioned one of the biggest pharmaceutical heists in history that took place over the weekend in Connecticut. Thieves stole $75 million worth of drugs, mostly antidepressants, from an Eli Lilly warehouse. For more on where those drugs might turn up, we're joined by Gil Kerlikowske, director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. Mr. Kerlikowske, good morning.
Good morning.
A real head-scratcher. Had you ever heard of a black market for antidepressant drugs, which is what was mostly stolen yesterday?
No, I haven't. I can tell you that there is a huge market for pharmaceuticals that are either fraudulently made, and we have seen an increase across the country in robberies and holdups and burglaries to pharmacies, but to see one this massive was quite something.
Well, Gil Kerlikowske, stay with us. The crisis in prescription drug abuse. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
President Obama is expected to sign a jobs bill today. It gives tax breaks for companies who hire unemployed workers. A U.S. official says a missile strike last week killed an al-Qaeda leader linked to the December suicide bombing of a CIA post in Afghanistan.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is visiting Moscow this morning, hoping to push a long-delayed nuclear arms control deal across the finish line. Former President Bill Clinton will travel to Haiti on Monday with former President George W. Bush. They'll assess the aid effort and establish recovery goals there. And Kraft Foods says it will cut the salt content of products it sells in North America by 10% over the next 2 years. The company says more than 1,000 products will be affected. The good economic news is moving the markets, but the Asian markets are down this morning. European indices are up, and as we mentioned, futures are up on the latest economic news on Wall Street. The Dow gets underway this hour at 10,733. The S&P opens at 1,166, and the Nasdaq opens at 2389. You know, the Dow is at an 18-month high. Coming up this hour, our census coverage continues. We talk about how views of race have really changed because of the census's change in its categories. That's later in the show.
We're also taking a look at this report that shows the middle class is losing their health care coverage faster than anybody else. You can get to more details at thetakeaway.org. But it got us thinking about health care costs and priorities. How do you make priorities? What do you pay for? What do you not pay for when health care costs are really high? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or at our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, a conversation with America's drug czar about that drug heist in Connecticut.
We'll be right back.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with a story that we told you about yesterday. One of the biggest pharmaceutical heists in history, which took place in Connecticut over the weekend, when thieves stole $75 million worth of drugs from an Eli Lilly distribution warehouse. They were mostly antidepressant drugs. And it may just be a snapshot of both an economic problem and an abuse problem with prescription drugs in this country, which is why we asked Gil Kerlikowske, who's the director of White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, to join us on the program. We spoke with him a moment ago. He's back with us. Gil Kerlikowske, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, we were thinking about this $75 million worth of drugs that were taken from this Eli Lilly warehouse. And you've talked on many occasions about prescription drug problems in the United States being perhaps equally serious to illicit drug problems that you're often asked about. There are some criminals that are betting that they can unload $75 million worth of not narcotics, not painkillers, not, you know, sort of recreational drugs, but antidepressants on the black market. How is that possible, sir?
Well, I think the concern is always about the fact that some drugs have been illicitly manufactured and given fraudulent labels, oftentimes overseas. Some drugs are sold through the Internet. And I think that's always been a warning that that health officials have given to the American consumers to be very careful, very wary, particularly if the deal looks too good to be true. But we know with the cost of prescription drugs, that people are going to look and figure out a way to make money if they can. You just have to realize the great danger to people's health with this kind of a problem.
Well, I'm listening to what you say. You refer to there the rising cost of prescription drugs. It sounds as though the pricing policies of drug companies, which vary from country to country, in a sense creates a pretty huge problem for someone like you who's supposed to control drug distribution, prescription, and illicit drugs.
Well, the issue for us, quite frankly, has been the prescription opioid painkillers and the rising increase across the country. We've seen more deaths from or drug-induced deaths than gunshot wounds. In 17 states, we've seen more fatalities from drugs than from car crashes. And that should be a real wake-up call. And this is led by prescription drug overdoses. And, of course, these aren't coming into the country from illicitly from another country. They are actually coming right out of our own medicine cabinets.
And the growth of demand on the prescription side, it seems to me, has had the net effect of commodifying these opioids so that they're really very easily obtainable on the black market. And I'm wondering if there's any way to really reverse that.
Well, they have been. They've been obtained, quite frankly, through people who doctor shop. They have been obtained through physicians in so-called pill mills, particularly in South Florida, where they are working very hard to get that under control. And one of the ways to get it under control is that about 40 states have prescription drug monitoring programs, electronic databases that allow health officials to look at doctors who may be over-prescribing or patients who may be doctor shopping.
Now, if these criminals are able to unload antidepressants, they aren't controlled substances in the way doctors are monitored in their prescription frequency for opioids. Doctors, I understand, have to fill out separate paperwork to write prescriptions for things like OxyContin or Vicodin, right?
That's exactly right. The narcotic painkillers are the more highly controlled substances. And those are the ones that the prescription drug monitoring plans are the ones they're most attuned to looking for problems in that area.
Based on this heist and possibly a growing black market for other drugs like, say, Viagra, et cetera, would you propose extending those regulations to drugs outside of the opioid category?
Well, I'm not sure that would help in particular. This seems to be a very well organized, as some of the other cases were, group of thieves who obviously knew exactly where they were going, what they wanted to take, and they obviously have a market somewhere, someplace to unload this.
Well, I guess I'm wondering, you know, your job is big enough as it is, but are you possibly looking at a historical turning point here where this problem is about to get much bigger?
Well, we'll be meeting with the Drug Enforcement Administration and talking with them, because they have investigators throughout the United States, and to try and find out if, in fact, this is more of a particular organized ring or if these are throughout the country. So I think there's probably more to find out about this story. But this is the one that really raised the red flag, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it does make me worry that your job is actually going to, you know, double or triple. Let me talk about another story that's actually been dominating the headlines this week. The violence, of course, over the weekend in Ciudad Juarez, directly a result of the war between the Mexican government and drug cartels south of the border. Violence is a real problem in Juarez. And Felipe Calderon, the president of Mexico, told our partners, the BBC, this week that the violence is a problem for both the U.S. and Mexico, and it has its origin, he said, in the consumption of drugs in the U.S. and the criminality associated with trafficking. It's a demand problem north of the border, according to the Mexican president. What's your response to that?
Well, one, Secretary Clinton, several months ago in her trip to Mexico, and I think she was followed closely by the Attorney General and also by Secretary Napolitano from the Department of Homeland Security. But Secretary Clinton clearly admitted and said, look, the drug problem is a shared responsibility. It's also an important responsibility of the United States to reduce our own demand, and there is no doubt about that. But there's another important part to keep in mind, and that is in the countries I visited, including Mexico, Colombia, Russia, Afghanistan, there is a growing addict population, and that is because traffickers pay their employees with the product rather than with cash. And so when they have this extra product, they turn and literally infect or addict some of the most impoverished people in the world, and it should be a concern on a global nation issue.
Finally, with health care reform looking for a vote this weekend, if more people lose their health insurance and can't afford prescription drugs, does that enlarge the demand and the market for prescription drugs and increase this problem before we go?
Well, here's what's going on with that. And as far as people using these painkillers, they become addicted to them, and then when they can't get off them, they turn to heroin, and we are seeing an increase there.
All right, Gil Kulikowski, Director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy in Washington, D.C. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some other stories we're following.
Lawmakers will continue to work on health care through the weekend. They're expected to review a cost analysis from the Congressional Budget Office today. A vote may take place on Sunday. And the number of newly laid off workers requesting jobless benefits fell slightly last week. That's the third week in a row we've seen a fall. Meanwhile, consumer prices stayed flat.
The number of sandbags in Fargo, North Dakota, planning for flooding, 1 million.
Wow.
Packed and stacked. Residents are waiting to see if the effort is enough to hold back the rising waters of the Red River. Lloyd Paulson lives along the river, and this morning he tells CNN he's prepared.
The covers are all stocked up, so, and the freezer is stocked up, so I can stay here for weeks without having to go out.
The Red River rose over 30 feet on Wednesday and is expected to crest at 38 feet on Sunday.
Have you ever packed sandbags?
No.
It's like coming home from a day at the beach. There's sand in everything when you do that.
Well, it's a bit of an emergency for National Guard troops who are on standby.
Obviously.
If the floods threaten homes over the weekend, prosecutors say the Wachovia Bank will pay $160 million to settle a federal lawsuit relating to illegal drug profits. Isn't that a shocker?
Hmm.
The money was laundered through Mexican businesses. It's unclear how much the bank knew about the illicit scheme. Finally, the Senate passed legislation that would make convictions for cocaine offenses more equal. That's as critics say unequal sentencing around the country unfairly punishes African Americans.
That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, March Madness begins shortly after noon Eastern. Today we're going to talk about what games you should watch and when, which ones you may see some surprises in. That's in a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
It's time for some takeouts on stories you're following this week. We've got Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen here. He's going to be talking about March Madness in a moment. But, you know, the NCAA brackets aren't the only paperwork that people are filling out at this time of the year.
Because I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man.
There's a story appearing in today's New York Times that puts a prescient spin on this classic from George Harrison. Several European governments are levying taxes on everything from candy, soft drinks, and even horses. Horses, Louise Story. Louise Story, Wall Street and Finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Your horse is taxed. Explain this to me.
Good morning. That's in the United Kingdom. Yes, they're adding a horse tax. It is supposedly paying for an agricultural bureau they're founding. Another favorite one that from this article that I saw was in Northern Ireland. They're raising the dog license tax, and it's even happening in the U.S. A lot of local governments, for instance, in Florida, in a town called Winter Haven, instead of having the general public pay when there are auto accidents, they're levying a tax on the person who was at fault. The first responder tax will go to the person who caused the car accident. And what this is, you know, kind of a usury tax. These are taxes for the people who are buying the sodas, or the people who are using these services. But you can also look at them a bit as stealth taxes, because revenue from these taxes will, in general, go to the treasury of these governments and help fill the holes where their income taxes or corporate taxes have fallen.
So what makes these popular? I mean, there's tons of them. If you read the article, they're in every part of the world, in every state of the union, they have these. Why do governments want to use these kind of taxes?
So a lot of governments have pledged not to raise taxes. And these taxes are kind of stealth taxes, because you don't increase the income tax. For instance, in France, President Sarkozy, when he was elected in 2007, pledged that he would not raise taxes. But critics of his there have said he actually has created 20 new taxes, but they're taxes of this sort.
They have other names for them.
Right. They have other names. But the reason,
remember in the Reagan administration what they called the fees that they would raise?
What they call them?
Revenue enhancements.
There you go. But the reason that they're popular with governments is an important one, and it's that they're not as tied to the economic cycle. So normal taxes on your income or on companies, when there's a growth in the economy, those go up. But when the economy falls, those go down. And think about it. With the bad economy, this is when we need government services the most. So the government has a lot of expenses now, but income taxes are down. The revenue from those is not as much because we're not making as much money. So this sort of taxes will provide more income to governments even when the economy is bad.
So are we expecting any of these coming out from our own federal government?
You know, I don't know of any stealth taxes coming,
that
but that's the nature. They're secretive. So keep your eyes open. And certainly we've got a big hole to fill in the U.S., so you may see some taxes of the sort.
Okay, Louise Story, Wall Street and Finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times.
If you see a stealth tax out there, give us a call and we'll report it to Louise right away. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. Good morning, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
So it seems to me the early rounds of the NCAA tournament that gets underway today, right? It's all about finding the Cinderella team, finding that team that's going to break out and maybe do some upsets, not watching the top seeds, right?
Well, okay, so that's interesting. You can watch it. I have four ways to watch it. You can watch the top seeds to see who's actually, if you want to follow a team and see their run, a epic run. You can also look for high-scoring talent. Look for someone who's really good, who's just going to drop tons of points. And then there's also, look for location. These are all at neutral sites. Some of these kids are going to be flying across the country, have never played. You get energy from playing in a home crowd. You get energy from playing in an away crowd. You get psyched up for that. But when you're playing at a neutral site, how do these kids respond to that? And then also the 10, 11, 12 seeds versus the 6, 7, and 5 seeds. That's where you'll get upsets.
So you want the middle seeds. That's really the first round game that you're going to choose. And, you know, the high scores, we don't really know yet until the tournament gets started. What are you picking for your first round game?
Well, BYU versus Florida, that's where you'll get Jimmer Fredette. He's averaged 21.7 points a game. He scored in his last two games in his conference tournament 45 and 30 points respectively. So if you want to see a really good score, Jimmer Fredette, BYU, Florida. Also, you have Lehigh versus Kansas if you want to watch a number one seed make their tournament run.
Kansas fanatics will watch.
Precisely.
I mean, that's going to be a blowout. But what about this? The president, I guess, is going to be watching what game?
Murray State versus Vanderbilt. That's a potential upset game because Murray State's ranked, they're picked to be their 13th and then Vanderbilt's 4th. Their seed. So that's an interesting game. Also, Washington versus Marquette. That's another potential upset.
Really?
With Marquette over Washington, even though they're very similar in their style of play and very close. The game that I think is interesting in terms of where they're actually playing, San Diego State versus Tennessee.
Right.
In Providence.
So they're both at a totally neutral site.
Completely.
They've both flown a lot of miles to get where they're going. Now, everybody loves to watch Butler.
So let's see, Butler.
It's Butler versus UTEP. Butler's a number 5 seed.
Yes.
UTEP's a number 12. A lot of people want Butler to emerge because
everyone's
picking them as the Cinderella
Everyone has
team.
Butler, exactly.
Yeah.
And then I love the Obama pick, too, just to go back to that real quick. So I think people are looking for shocks in the first round because they are expecting them. But everyone's picking for number one teams to make it through because they're so talented.
And, you know, you mentioned Obama. And he, by legend and by report,
yeah.
is obsessed with this.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
So you know he's
he has a presidential bracket.
I mean, he must be able, he must have like 12 screens. Yeah. He reminds me of the guy yesterday we were talking to in Vegas.
Oh, yeah.
He's going out to look at 18 screens. So what will you be watching today?
I really want to see this guy, Jimmer Fredette. I know that may not be the game to see, but he's supposedly one of the he's the 12th highest scoring kid in the nation. He's dropped 25 points 10 times this year. So there's something about seeing these individual talent in this first round because you may not see them after that.
Right. Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway Sports Contributor. You can go to our website. Ibrahim's got his bracket filled out. Celeste's got her bracket filled out. And, of course, I've got this. It's not a rant exactly. It's my feeling that, you know, I hate the brackets.
It's a monograph.
And I responded with my own blog saying
I don't like the brackets because I love the fact that all these players may be playing the last game of their entire career. Most don't go out in the NBA. That's what I love about it. I don't like to bet on the NBA.
I don't like the bet either. I went with my heart, and that's what makes it
all
tough.
Right.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, the Vatican is trying to address the sexual abuse crisis which has flared up in Europe, but the Vatican's hampered by the Pope's own possible credibility problem in Germany from his own archdiocese there. More details on that in a few moments, but first let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. In the past 15 minutes, House Democrats released the details of the health care bill. They say it'll cost $940 billion over the next 10 years. They also say the bill will cut the deficit by $130 billion over the first 10 years and more than $1 trillion over the second 10. The official report on the cost of the bill will come from the Congressional Budget Office later this morning. Meanwhile, House Democrats are reportedly about 10 votes shy of the 216 they need to pass the bill. Democratic Pennsylvania Congressman Jason Altmaier voted against the bill the first time. This time, he says he's undecided and tells ABC News this morning,
"It's been unbelievable. We're getting phone calls and emails by the tens of thousands on this from all around the country. There were two planes in Pittsburgh flying over the city yesterday saying, tell Altmaier to vote no on health care."
Congressman Altmaier says he'll decide which way he's going to vote before the weekend.
Here's a story about someone who's not exactly a godfather. Italian police have been after an alleged mafia hitman who calls himself Scarface for over a year, but he's behind bars this morning. Turns out he was addicted to Facebook, logging on dozens of times a day. I suppose he put his occupation down. He was on so often, police were eventually able to track him down by tracing his IP address. The president's going to sign a jobs bill later this morning. It'll give tax breaks for companies who hire unemployed workers, and the markets may react to that. Wall Street is open this morning. It's a mixed opening. The S&P is down a fraction. The Nasdaq's down about 2 points. And the Dow, meanwhile, is up about 4.5. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
In recent months, the church has been severely shaken as a result of the child abuse crisis.
That's the voice of Pope Benedict XVI. He's responding to a rising tide of anger in Europe as new cases of alleged sexual abuse come to light. And he also said yesterday he'll write an open letter to Irish Catholics on Friday to foster what he calls repentance, healing, and renewal. Rachel Donadio is a Rome bureau chief for the New York Times. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning.
Rachel, you interviewed the man who investigates these kind of cases for the Vatican. He now has hundreds of new cases coming from the Netherlands and Germany and from Ireland. Does he feel that the Catholic Church is equipped to thoroughly investigate all these cases?
Well, let's get a couple things clear. I spoke the other day to Monsignor Charles Scicluna, who is essentially the Vatican's internal prosecutor. He is in charge of an office that examines the hundreds and, in fact, actually 3,000 cases that have come across the desk of the Vatican in the past decade after already having been examined in local dioceses around the world. He does have an office of about 10 people, and what he said is that if the number of cases that reach that stage, which is for kind of final decision by the Vatican on how to proceed with these priests, whether they should leave the priesthood or have some other kind of punishment, if he has about 300 cases a year, he thinks his office can handle it. But if the number of cases is going to rise, which in recent weeks it seems like it certainly has, then perhaps that office isn't big enough. The real issue is more about how these issues of child sex abuse are being confronted in local churches around the world.
And do you feel as though they're being thoroughly investigated locally?
Well, I think that that's a hard question to answer, but let's just say this. In recent weeks and months, there have been vast numbers of cases that have come to light in Pope Benedict XVI's native Germany and also in Ireland, which in the last year there have been released two extremely scathing government reports, one documenting decades of abuse, psychological, sexual, physical, of children in church-run institutions for the poor, and another kind of involving cover-ups of priests involved in child sex abuse. That case in Ireland has become so pronounced that yesterday the top official in Ireland, Cardinal Sean Brady, really apologized from the bottom of his heart for what had gone on in that country. There's even some talk that he might resign. In Benedict's native Germany, the issue is even more delicate because one of these abuse cases essentially passed under Benedict, who was then Archbishop of Munich, a priest who was found to have been abusing children, was reassigned by Benedict, then Archbishop Ratzinger, to have a kind of therapy done in Munich. And then another bishop underneath Benedict reassigned this priest to do pastoral work. So the question is kind of who knew what when, and it's caused such outrage in Germany that the Justice Minister of Germany has accused the Vatican of perpetuating a wall of silence that makes it difficult for these cases to come forward in civil courts. It's a huge credibility question.
And it's complicated, and that's one of the reasons that the Pope is going to issue this open letter to Irish Catholics tomorrow. Rachel Donadio is the Rome Bureau Chief for the New York Times. We turn now to David Clossy, National Director for SNAP. That's the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
There's a connection here between what's going on in Ireland and what's going on in the United States. And one of the places in which these paths sort of cross is a case that your organization has worked on in South Bend, Indiana, that kind of demonstrates the ties between Europe and the U.S. and kind of also demonstrates the multinational nature of the Catholic Church. Can you explain the case of Francis Markey, who was suspended from the priesthood in Ireland because of allegations that he twice raped a boy?
Yes, he was suspended in Ireland and somewhat mysteriously showed up living in Indiana, working in Michigan. There's been no clarity from the three bishops involved, Michigan, Ireland, and Indiana, about who sent him there and why. And he was only suspended recently and arrested and charged because of the alleged crimes in Ireland. And what it shows is simply that very little has changed. Maybe instead of sending predator priests from one corner of a diocese to another, bishops are now sending them further afield. And the wall of secrecy that the German justice minister mentioned, sadly, is not unique to Germany. It's, in fact, characteristic of the church's handling, even today, of these terrible, terrible crimes and cover-ups literally across the globe.
So the Irish government is trying to extradite Francis Markey, and he is fighting that. And it calls to mind the fact that the Catholic Church is a multinational organization. What kind of restrictions do we have? Maybe are there restrictions and oversight that would be similar to what we would have for a multinational corporation?
There's absolutely none. It is a global monarchy, a rigid, ancient, secretive, all-male monarchy, accountable to absolutely no one. And that's why, Celeste, the crucial reforms that must happen to protect kids have to come from the secular sphere. I mean, we in America are proud of our former government. We know that this system of checks and balances is really effective. It reduces the abuse of power. But there's nothing, absolutely nothing in the church structure or history or practice that stops a local bishop from doing almost anything he wants to. Outside of doctrine, if a local bishop preaches in favor of married priests, of course, Rome comes down on him like a ton of bricks. But when it comes to anything else, including, sadly, the safety of kids, every bishop is a lord of his own kingdom, answerable to no one. And that's why we continue to see the kinds of cover-ups that are surfacing in Europe, we continue to see that very same destructive behavior happen today. It's crucial that people understand that, you know, these are not crimes and cover-ups of the past. It's absolutely happening today.
David Klossy is the National Director of SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. Thanks so much for joining us. That open letter from the Pope to Irish Catholics will be released on Saturday. Coming up later this hour, our census coverage continues. We're going to talk about the views of how race changed later on in the show. But as we follow the census, we're asking for your reactions to how you fill out the form. What are your reactions to the questions there? What's your sort of take on the boxes you have to fill in the census? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is visiting Moscow today, which is why we spoke earlier this morning with Rupert Wingfield Hayes, the BBC Moscow correspondent. The two-day visit is to attend a meeting on the Middle East between the U.S., the European Union, the United Nations, and Russia, members of the so-called Quartet, which is dealing with such issues as the Arab-Israeli Peace Initiative and also Iran. Rupert Wingfield Hayes was asked whether the U.S. and Russia might now be closer to agreement on the issue of sanctions against Iran.
Well, there's certainly more agreement than there was, say, a year ago. Russia and China have always been seen as being closer to Iran and more protective of Iran when it comes to discussing tougher sanctions. And in the past, Russia has been, as a member of the UN Security Council, one of the obstacles in the way of imposing tougher sanctions against Iran. I have to say, in the last few months here, there has been a noticeable shift by the Russian government, much closer towards the position taken by the United States and other European countries, Britain and France as well, in that Russia says that the Iranians are clearly not playing ball with the UN inspection regime, and I think the discovery of a new secret site near the city of Qom in Iran last September, certainly surprised the Russians. And now certainly their rhetoric suggests they are closer to the American position and may be willing to support tougher sanctions.
Although, Rupert Wingfield Hayes, how do you evaluate this statement from Nikolai Kotchernov, who's Russia's deputy ambassador to NATO, who seemed to be emphasizing the disagreement, not agreement? Listen.
Iran is a very difficult issue. We haven't got the same view on some specific things like Iran nuclear program, for example.
Are the Russians hedging their bets here?
Well, what the Russians don't want to see is military action against Iran. They've been very, very clear about that from the start. And so when they hear, for example, the Israeli government talking about the need to take very tough action against Iran, it certainly makes the Russian position very nervous. But I genuinely think that they have moved their position. I think the real obstacle for the United States now in trying to push for tougher sanctions is not so much in Moscow, but it is in Beijing. The Chinese government is still very firmly entrenched in its support of Iran.
The other two items on this meeting involve trying to get a broad coalition of nations to pressure Israel on the settlement issue. Is Russia likely to be involved in that? And there's also a nuclear treaty in the balance.
That's right. These are the two other big issues. Well, certainly on the issue of settlements, Russia's position is very clearly in opposition to what the Israeli government has announced. It has heavily criticized the announcement of a new building of housing in East Jerusalem. So in that sense, Russia is on the same page as the United States and the European Union and the UN on this issue. The trouble is Russia does not have a huge amount of leverage with Israel. Everybody is going to be sitting here in Moscow saying, well, this is terrible and we need to get the Israelis to move on this, but really everybody knows that the only country that has any clout with Israel is the United States.
That was Rupert Wingfield Hayes, BBC Moscow correspondent, who joined us earlier this morning. One more expected headline out of this trip, potentially. The U.S. and Russia have been negotiating for almost a year on that new nuclear treaty, and there's hope that this agreement might get wrapped up on this trip by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Coming up, we talk more about the census and what it means if you check the box marked white as your race. If you have a story to tell when you filled out your form, you can reach us at 8778-MY-TAKE. More in just a few minutes.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley. I'm here with John Hockenberry. John, have you filled out your census form?
Oh, yes.
You might have noticed that, if you're, say, Hispanic, there's lots of different choices on where you came from, mm-hmm. right? Same for, African-American. There's the other choices you can mix in there. But if you're white, there's just the white. There's no, different kinds.
Whitey, actually.
Oh, there's a whitey option?
Yeah. If it had been there, I would have checked that. But.
Right. Okay. Well, we're going to be talking about checking that box next to white, what it means, and the history behind that choice in a few minutes. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. In the past hour, the House Democrats say the health care bill will cost $940 billion over 10 years. They say the bill will reduce the deficit by at least $130 billion in the first decade and $1.2 trillion in the second decade. The official cost analysis from the Congressional Budget Office, though, is expected around midday today. The earliest possible date for a House vote on the bill is Sunday.
One more Washington story. President Obama will sign an $18 billion jobs bill today. So here's a little nugget. Once upon a time, there's a group of British fishermen singing about life on the sea.
The anchors are weighed and the sails are unfurled.
This group here, singing in a pub in Cornwall, when they were spotted by an agent from a major record label.
You're kidding me.
They've just signed a deal worth $1 million.
That doesn't really happen.
Sea shanties. Future of music. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
We've been talking this week about the Census Bureau. People are getting their forms in the mail, and probably as we speak, and making decisions like the one you and I were talking about over whether or not even to fill in that box next to white, black, Hispanic, white, Samoan. But these categories change drastically as our cultural views of race change. Back in the 1830s and 40s, for example, your choices on the census form were white, black, Indian, and different kinds of what people called mulattoes or mixed race people. Now whites is just one category among a whole host of them. But what it means to be other than white happens a lot more often than it used to, but we don't very often talk about what it means to be white. But somebody who's thought a lot about it is Nell Irvin Painter. She's the author of the new book, The History of White People. It basically says whiteness is a concept. It's not a thing. And there's a complex history behind it. So let me ask you, Nell, I'm very multiracial. So when I go to fill in my census box, I know what I'm going to check. But in the early days of the census, part of my background was black. I probably have to check the box next to black only, right? One drop of blood would have made me African-American.
You wouldn't have had that choice. The possibility of the person being able to decide is something new. So in the 19th century, the census taker would go around and look at you and decide. So from one decade to another, your race could change.
And you were in a box, and once you were in that box, that was the end.
No, you could get out of the box if the next 10 years the census taker decided you were somewhere else. So,
but they named the
plus
boxes.
They named the boxes, but the categories changed. So you mentioned that there was mulatto at one point. I think it was the 1840s or the 1850s. It came and went fairly quickly. But in the early 20th century, white people started getting broken down again into immigrant, native-born, where were you born, where were your parents born, and so forth. And the immigrant white stuff started disappearing in the middle of the 20th century. But I should say in 1790, for the first census, the only race named was white, and there were four or five different categories.
You know, let me ask you about what was your thought in terms of writing this book, which clearly took you a very long time. I mean,
it
the
did.
Research is thorough.
Yeah, a century.
I mean, it's a provocative title.
Yeah.
And it's written by an African-American woman. And I have to stop and ask myself, what made you, as you were thinking about your place as an African-American woman and all the racial issues that you deal with on a daily basis and have your whole life, why did you come down to saying, I want to talk about whiteness?
I was so naive. I thought that having a PhD and being a historian and doing lots and lots of research would qualify me for writing on whatever I wanted. It really was a question of curiosity. I started off with the question, well, why are white people called Caucasian? Huh? That was where
I've
started.
Never been to the
if
Caucasus.
It hadn't been in the Caucasus Mountains.
Yeah.
And you ended up with this entire examination of what is white.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things you talk about in your book, how originally people separated others according to where they lived or what they did in their daily life, whether they were warriors or farmers, mm-hmm. and not their color of their skin. And this all mishmash began to change in the United States when we got so many immigrants. We didn't know how to handle the people coming from other countries where they were born.
Well, handle, let's say categorize. How's
right.
that? Yeah. separation was a question of segregation, and that that was, in law at least, uniquely aimed toward people of African descent. Mm. But in terms of categorization, those categories have changed time and time again. And as you note, they often pertain to immigration. And so the people who get stigmatized by race are the people who were doing the low-paid or unpaid dirty work. So in the black-white system, it's black people or Negroes. And in the white systems, it's either the Celtic race of the mid-19th century, the Irish, or in the early 20th century, the Jewish race, the Italian race, the Slavic race.
Since you're speaking about that particular time, we have this clip of tape from former New York Governor Alfred Smith. He was Irish-American. He's talking about...
He was half Irish-American.
He talks about this very thing in the neighborhood where he was growing up. This is part of a series of speeches from 1943 that were supposed to try and unify people during the war effort.
At the public school where I was stationed, which, by way, was on Oliver Street, parents were of every race in the world, Irish, Jewish, Italians, Poles, Spaniards, Greeks, Slavs, and a lot more that I don't remember.
That's great.
That's every race in the world there.
Yeah.
Which all happens to be races that we now think of as white.
Pretty much so. And there, until quite recently, until the 1960s, there were two racial dialogues going on in the United States. One was more or less Southern, and that was black-white. And the other had to do with various kinds of white people, which is what Alfred Smith was talking about. So when in 43, which is in the middle of the switch, but in the 20s, if you said the racial problem and you were talking about any place outside the South, it would be the races that he enumerated. Mm.
You know, one of the things that you have captured so smartly in your book is the fact that there's no real such thing as white, that it has been so mutable over the course of history. Well, that when people talk about white, which, you know, if you go back to Greek and Roman times, there was no such thing.
Yeah.
But when the idea of white as a race came into being, that meant something totally different as each generation went by and they started adding people in and taking people out of it.
Yeah, I wouldn't say totally different, but certainly different enough so that the discourse changed. And I also wouldn't say white is not maybe it's not a thing, but it definitely is a concept, and a concept that changes changes as having changed over time.
Having finished this historical view, did you find hope that eventually these racial distinctions will be less important?
Yes and no. I think already the racial distinctions are less important than they were in the age of segregation and extreme poverty for the people considered alien races. So whiteness is not what it used to be. On the other hand, we still have, and as long as we have this tremendous disparity of wealth and income in our country, we will still have the Negro or black people as the poor. And currently, with this enormous disparity of income and wealth, the poor are now and will remain disproportionately dark-skinned.
Okay, it's a fascinating book. It's called
Thank
The History
you.
Of White People. The author is Nell Irvin Painter. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our census coverage continues online. You can weigh in on how you think about race when you fill out your form.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I'm calling from Tenafly, New Jersey. And I had an interesting moment with the census where my husband's Filipino, I'm white. And for our two children, I checked the box Filipino. Should I have checked Filipino and white? I'm still not sure. Interesting moment for me.
Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and you can also hear segments on how to do the census better. It's all at thetakeaway.org.
While you're at it, we've seen a landslide of suggestions from listeners for the Takeaways T-shirt contest. That's right. How do you want to be seen around town knowing that you're a Takeaway listener? We've been making new T-shirts and are looking for your help by asking for a 6-word slogan to go on a cotton shirt. It can be on anything. Here are some of your entries.
Give the other crooks a chance.
It's still better than John McCain.
The Takeaway almost always gives back.
Whatever happened to common sense? Another entry.
That's
enough is enough. End stupidity. I like that one. Build a bridge. Get over it. I'd rather be sleeping. Ready for the world. Still time to submit your own idea. We'll post slogans for the top 10. We're going to vote, and then there will be a takeaway.org T-shirt.
With possibly your slogan on it. I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
I'm John Huckenberry. That's a good slogan.
Yeah.
I'm John Huckenberry. maybe a few more words.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.